So in the past few talks, we've heard a number of very nice results from MHD simulations of what the dynamics of accretion flows might be. So I want to start by reminding you that the system that we're interested in the galactic center is not one for which it's a priori obvious that MHD is applicable. The mean free paths of particles are extremely long. It's really a collisionless plasma that we're dealing with, and there's the possibility that even the global dynamics of the system, there are interesting kinetic effects in terms of understanding the dynamics of what's going on. And that's a little bit of what I want to talk about. And this work is in collaboration with various people. Most notably, I'll mention Pratik Sharma, who's a graduate student at Princeton, who's done some very nice simulations, and Greg Hammett, who's also at Princeton, who's here in the audience. So just to set the stage, let me point out a couple of simple numbers. We observe this beautiful hot gas, or more precisely, there is this beautiful hot gas in the central region of the galaxy. We can measure the density and temperature of the gas just from the thermal X-ray emission. At distances of about an arcsecond from the black hole, which is about as close as we can get, that's the Bondi capture radius that Chris mentioned. It's about 100,000 Schwarzschild radii. We get temperatures of a few keV, densities of about 100 particles per centimeter cubed. At that temperature and that density, the time scale for electrons and protons to come into thermal equilibrium with each other is about 2,000 years. That time scale is significantly longer than the time it takes the plasma to move across the Bondi radius, a time scale of order 100 years. So there's no obvious reason why you would expect, for example, the electrons and protons to be in thermal equilibrium and have the same temperature under these conditions. In fact, I would argue that there's good reasons to think that they wouldn't. This hot gas is produced by shocked stellar winds. Other examples we know of collisionless shocks, such as supernova remnants, generically generate different electron and proton temperatures. And so it's not obvious when you're looking at this image that the electron temperature that you measure from the X-rays has anything to do with the proton temperature. This is actually a non-trivial issue in interpreting the observations, because we want to use the temperature we see to infer what the Bondi capture radius is. If the electrons and protons don't have the same temperature, then that complicates this inference. In principle, you can get around this. You can determine this observationally. In supernova remnants, you look at X-ray emission from electrons. You look at ion temperature from various lines. And you can try to constrain both the electron and the proton temperature. It's not clear in the galactic center that we have the diagnostics to do that. This problem, of course, becomes infinitely worse as we head in towards the black hole. My favorite parameters within of order 10 Schwarzschild radii are something like those listed there. Proton temperature of hundreds of MeV, 10 to the 12 Kelvin. Electrons are maybe a little bit colder. The density is similar to the density of the solar corona, 10 to the 6 particles per centimeter cubed. If you naively calculate how far does a proton go before it runs into another proton, it travels about a kiloparsec. Okay? So this is an incredibly macroscopically collisionless system. Of course, in reality, we think there are magnetic fields there. The magnetic fields help allow the plasma to behave in a more fluid-like way, but it's an unsolved problem to what extent MHD, which assumes very short mean free paths, much less than the size of the Schwarzschild radius, not, you know, 9 orders of magnitude larger, it's an unsolved problem to what extent MHD actually accurately describes the dynamics of collisionless plasmas. So one of the things we've been interested in is to try to take a step back and ask, what if you try to approach this problem by looking at the dynamics of a magnetized collisionless plasma accreting onto a central black hole? Are there interesting differences with respect to MHD, for example? So let me start just by pointing out that we think Charles didn't go into much detail. He mentioned a dynamical instability that allows you to accrete. This is the MRI, the magnetorotational instability, that generates large magnetic fields, generates a turbulent plasma, transports angular momentum. This is just a plot of the growth rate of this instability as a function of wave vector. The details aren't that important. This shows the results in MHD, and these are various calculations we did in kinetic theory where you can get interesting differences in the dynamics of the basic instability that transports angular momentum in accretion disks. And the reason this arises more or less is because if you have a magnetic field line connecting two parts of the plasma, you get angular momentum transport for two reasons. One is there's a magnetic stress that couples the two parts of the plasma, and that transports angular momentum. But you also just move particles very quickly along magnetic field lines from one region to another. And you actually have bulk transport of momentum and heat along magnetic field lines. And that is the essential physics that changes the dynamics of the angular momentum transport in this collisionless system. A growth rate of the instability in units of the orbital frequency of the disk. So this is one dynamical instability that's crucial for accretion to proceed. Another dynamical instability that we heard about, that Chris mentioned quite a bit, is convection. These hot accretion flows, Ramesh mentioned this as well, because they're hot, they're generically expected to be buoyantly unstable. That generates convective motions, the kind that Chris showed in his simulations. There's a very nice paper by Steve Balbus about 5 years ago now, which showed that in a low-density system where you have efficient heat conduction along magnetic field lines, that you significantly change the properties of convection. Normally, I'm ignoring rotation here, but normally a plasma goes convectively unstable when it has a negative entropy gradient. Entropy determines the buoyancy of the plasma. This is the Schwarzschild criterion that we teach everybody in undergraduate and graduate school. In a magnetized plasma, the results are actually a little bit different. So the idea is, as a toy problem, imagine the following. Imagine I just have an atmosphere, gravity pointing down, the temperature increasing in the direction of gravity, and I initially have a magnetic field in this direction, and I displace a fluid element along with the magnetic field line vertically in this direction. The key thing that happens in a collisionless plasma is that the time scale to conduct energy along the magnetic field line is shorter than the time scale of the buoyant motions that are trying to drive convection. And what that means is, because you transport heat efficiently along the magnetic field line, is you make the magnetic field lines isothermal. The temperature is everywhere the same along this magnetic field line. Okay? So then if you ask, I've just taken this fluid from one place and I've moved it up. I've taken a fluid element, I've moved it up here, but I've done it keeping its temperature the same, because the temperature along the field line is everywhere the same, because conduction is efficient. As a result, that means the criteria for whether the density at this new place is larger or greater than the ambient density of the fluid, okay, whether the density is larger or greater determines if you're buoyant. That's entirely determined just by whether the temperature of the plasma is larger or smaller than the ambient temperature. So convection in a collisionless system is determined by the temperature gradient, not the entropy gradient. So in principle, you can have very different dynamics for convective motions in these very low density, hot, long mean free path systems that we're interested in the context of the galactic center. So it's certainly possible that hydrodynamic and MHD simulations are not correctly capturing the physics of the dynamical instabilities that govern how accretion proceeds. There's some technical points about whether or not MHD might be okay even on large scales that we can talk about, but I think it's a very interesting question to try to look at. Instead of assuming that MHD is applicable, to try to take a step back and look at how the system behaves, what the dynamics of an accretion flow is from the point of view of a collisionless plasma, so kinetic calculations. There's a couple of ways that one could imagine trying to calculate the dynamics of a collisionless plasma. One is you actually follow the motion of every particle along every magnetic field line. This is kind of the particle and cell technique, for example. This is somewhat inefficient for the problem we're interested in, because particles move along the magnetic field line. They undergo cyclotron orbits on a time scale which is orders of magnitude shorter than the rotation period of the disk. So we don't so much care about this cyclotron motion. So what we've decided to do is instead use a way of describing the dynamics of collisionless plasmas called kinetic MHD. It's basically a theory that describes the behavior of collisionless plasmas on very large length scales and on very long time scales. You average over all this complicated kinetic behavior, okay, but you keep the large scale, long time scale dynamics. And in this theory, the equations you get, doesn't really matter, but the basic equations you get are almost the same as MHD, with one big difference, which is that the pressure is a tensor, not a scalar. You have a magnetic field line, there can be a different pressure perpendicular to the magnetic field and parallel to the magnetic field. There's nothing that's maintaining the same pressure in every direction like collisions do in MHD or hydrodynamics. Little b is a unit vector in the direction of the magnetic field. Okay. So this is just saying that in the direction of the magnetic field and perpendicular to the direction of the magnetic field, there can be different pressures. And so really, for understanding this dynamics of a collisionless plasma on very large scales, it's really how does this pressure tensor evolve that determines the large-scale dynamics of a collisionless system. You can write down evolution equations that describe how the pressure perpendicular to the magnetic field evolves and the pressure parallel to the magnetic field evolves. There's heat conduction, which is the point that Sergei brought up, that along magnetic field lines, you very efficiently transport heat, okay? That's a key effect that you have in the collisionless system that you don't have in MHD. The problem is we don't know how to write down exact expressions for what these heat fluxes are. If you've ever taken a class in fluid mechanics, this is the closure problem. You can't get a well-behaved set of fluid equations for a collisionless system. So what we do instead, and I can go into more details about this, is we're basically using approximations for these heat fluxes. This is not rigorous, but these are approximations which capture the key physics of what's going on. Namely, that on roughly a sound crossing time, you can wipe out temperature gradients along the magnetic field. And so to start with, we've started with basically the simplest problem, analogous to the simple problems when people were first looking at MHD simulations of accretion flows, which is you don't do a beautiful global system like what Charles described or what Chris described, but you just look at a simulation of a tiny little patch of an accretion disk. It's a local simulation of a patch of an accretion disk. And you ask, how does the magnetic field grow? How do you transport angular momentum? You want to understand the dynamics first of this little patch before moving to global simulations. And so this is just a plot. This is simulations in particular carried out by Pratik Sharma, this graduate student at Princeton. This is a plot of how the magnetic energy grows as a function of time. The three different curves are different components, radial, azimuthal, and vertical components of the magnetic field. So initially you have a weak magnetic field, the magnetic field grows. This is the growth of this instability, the MRI. The instability saturates and you reach a saturated turbulent state in which you have angular momentum transport. The key thing that's come out of these calculations is that in addition to having angular momentum transport by the magnetic field, the Maxwell stress associated with the magnetic field, you also have significant angular momentum transport associated with this anisotropic pressure, this bulk motion of plasma along magnetic field lines transporting angular momentum in the accretion flow. This is a plot of the ratio of the pressure stress to the magnetic stress as a function of time in orbits in this little patch of the accretion disk. And this shows that in the kinetic simulations, the rate of angular momentum transport is enhanced by a factor of order unity relative to MHD calculations because you have an additional physical mechanism for transporting angular momentum. So the magnetic stress turns out to be roughly comparable to what you get in MHD, and you have an anisotropic stress, which on average is about the same as the magnetic stress, so the total stress is larger by a factor of two. This is, it never really goes negative, right? This ratio is positive. It could in principle, that's right. That would counteract, right. Okay. That was, these equations are two different equations of state. Yes. Yes. So this is just a local patch, and actually I think what this shows is that to first order, the dynamics of a local patch of an accretion disk in a collisionless plasma are not all that different from MHD. You get enhanced angular momentum transport by about order unity, but roughly the dynamics is similar to what you would get if you looked at a local patch of an accretion disk in MHD. We've yet to do global simulations. This is an obvious next step, to look at whether there are any differences in the global dynamics of an accretion flow in the collisionless limit, in particular, whether these effects of heat conduction and convection driven by temperature gradients can modify the global dynamics of the system. It's shearing periodic boundary conditions. It's the same as in MHD. So we can talk about that later, but in these little patches, this is it's a shearing sheet approximation, which is the same as what people do in hydrodynamic or MHD, local patches of disks in hydro or MHD. Yeah, it's not, I agree, it's not completely obvious that that isn't increasing with time. I agree. Any other questions? Okay, let me, 1 second. All right, so I want to switch gears slightly. And I want to mention that an obvious goal of doing these more and more sophisticated simulations would be that we'd like to be able to ultimately connect the numerical simulations that are done to actual observations. So we've taken a step in this direction by trying to incorporate radiation into simulations of accretion flows. So for example, by actually calculating synchrotron radiation in a numerical simulation of an accretion flow. We haven't yet done this for these kinetic simulations because these are thus just a little patch of a disk, and looking at a little patch of a disk isn't all that interesting. You want to do a global simulation. So to start with, what we've done is calculate synchrotron radiation in an MHD simulation, not a kinetic simulation, an MHD simulation of one of these radiatively inefficient accretion flows. And this is an example of what you get out for a light curve for the synchrotron radiation as a function of time in a global MHD simulation of an accretion flow. Here, the black hole mass and time and everything are chosen for units that are appropriate for the galactic center. 3.6 million solar mass black hole sets the time scale that you're interested in. So this is a light curve, add a few millimeters. In particular, this calculation assumes optically thin synchrotron emission. And this kind of light curve is characteristic of the emission at any optically thin frequency. Okay? So similar variability we see in the calculations and would expect in the infrared. And what you're seeing here is basically, if you looked at Charles's movie of the accretion flow, it was this highly time-dependent accretion flow. And that turbulence that's transporting angular momentum manifests itself as a variable synchrotron emission when you calculate the radiation from the simulations. And you get factor of order unity, factor of few to five variability on a few hour time scales. And that characteristic time scale of a few hours is set by the orbital period near the black hole, which is where most of this high frequency emission is produced. So this is at least qualitatively satisfying in that it looks a little bit like what you see from the galactic center. I think actually doing anything more quantitative than this is going to be extraordinarily difficult. In particular, the infrared and X-ray flaring that we've seen, if you looked at the models that Sarah and Heino were describing and that Ramesh and I have also worked on, for where you get this infrared and X-ray variability, it's basically a form of, you know, plasma physics weather. You get this power law distribution function that's going up and down. We just put that in by hand. But the idea is that there's variable particle acceleration producing a non-thermal tail, which gives you variable infrared and X-ray emission. But this is going to be extraordinarily difficult to predict with any kind of certainty, right? Understanding the time-dependent particle acceleration in a collisionless magnetized plasma in GR is a very difficult problem, okay? So making these kinds of comparisons to observations, this is just a kind of cautionary note, I think will be extremely difficult. Not only is the problem of electron heating and acceleration a difficult one, but even if we put some energy in the plasma at one point, for the conditions appropriate to the galactic center, the conduction timescale, the timescale to move energy around by heat conduction, is much shorter than the inflow time of the plasma, and it's much shorter than the radiative cooling time. So the equilibrium temperature distribution of the plasma is set at some level by a balance between how you heat the plasma and how it conducts energy along magnetic field lines. So getting the predictions correct of actually, you know, what the emission is, especially at high frequencies where one is very sensitive to the non-thermal tail of the distribution function, this is I think theoretically a very daunting task. It may be a little bit more promising in the submillimeter, because under those conditions it looks like the emission is produced by the thermal population of electrons. So one will at least be a little bit less sensitive to this phenomenon of you're looking at the tail of the dog flapping up and down. Okay, I'll end there. Thanks.
Hi, can I ask the first question? Yep. You didn't comment on polarization. I know you did it. A thought occurred to me. That was a pseudo-Newtonian simulation.
Yes.
So I assume that you did not take into account general acoustic
no.
on the rate, but
that's correct.
Polarization, the positioning, and will the polarization be affected by that?
It, in principle, at high frequencies, the emission is coming from a few Schwarzschild radii, and that's something we're trying to do. Yeah. Magnetic field strength and density and temperature. The temperature and density fluctuate around, and the magnetic field strength fluctuates around, and so they all contribute to the variability. Right, so in this, remember, this calculation is based on an MHD calculation. We did something very simple, which just said the electron temperature is proportional to the total pressure in the MHD simulation. That may well be wrong, so there could be additional fluctuations from all of this complicated particle heating that we don't understand very well.
Yeah. So given all this uncertainty, will the periodicity of 1 or 2 hours come through?
Well, I think the question was, would we expect to see some time scale of a few hours? I mean, that was part of the argument that I would give, is that it's plausible that the characteristic time scales of variability have to do with underlying dynamics, characteristic periods of fluctuating turbulence at 3 or 4 Schwarzschild radii. The amplitudes, I think, are much harder to predict. That depends on all of, but you could hope that the characteristic time scale of a few hours would be something representative of the basic accretion flow dynamics. That's right.
Another question. Yeah.
Even though you thought it was interesting, whether you consider running that thing for 200 hours or 200 hours?
It takes a long time. I hope I didn't say it was uninteresting. It just takes a very, you know, it takes a long time. It's also there are limitations of what you can learn from these local simulations. So, I think one wants to go to do a more global calculation. So these local simulations are good at getting a physical understanding of what some of the relevant local physics is, but really you want to look at a global calculation. Alpha in local simulations is ill-defined and depends on the initial magnetic field threading the box. So that's why, well, it's twice what MHD gives you, so few tenths, 0.3, something of that order is plausible.
Actually, let me comment here. You cannot measure alpha.
It's very difficult. So
forget that. Don't trust anyone who claims that they've done a measure of alpha.
That's why I phrased it as a ratio of the anisotropic stress to the Maxwell stress rather than as an absolute value of the Maxwell stress to the pressure. So.
Explain that.
No. So the question was, do the simulations allow you to determine where the flow becomes optically thin? All of these numerical simulations have an arbitrary density normalization in them. So you put in by hand some a priori guess as to what the accretion rate close to the black hole or the density close to the black hole is, and that determines where the flow becomes optically thin. So the only way you could hope to do that is by the kinds of calculations that Chris was describing, where you connect the dynamics on the Bondi radius scale to the smaller scale dynamics. But any local simulation or even a global simulation like what Charles described, where you start at 100 Schwarzschild radii, you put in an arbitrary density in the plasma.
Any other questions? Yeah.
So what is electron conduction time?
I don't remember the numbers. I remember it in dimensionless units. Sorry. It's about 100 times, it's plausibly about 100 times shorter than the inflow time, and the inflow time is an hour or something like that, so it's a minute, you know, something of order a minute. It's a conduction, that's the key question. So that estimate actually was done using what people have tried to estimate. So the problem of thermal conduction in a random magnetic field has been looked at a lot, for example, by Steve Cowley, Ramesh, Ben Chandran, in the context of X-ray clusters. So if I use their best guess for the true radial conduction, that's what I was using in these estimates. So along field lines is even more rapid, but you could imagine that even radially through the turbulent plasma, the conduction time is much shorter than the inflow time and the cooling time scale. That part is, I would say that's less certain. Along the field line is clear. Perpendicular to the field line is less certain.
So.
So for these, you know, I think close to the black hole, the electrons are moving at roughly the speed of light. So the, like, as long as the temperature is above a few billion Kelvin, they're moving at the speed of light, so. Right. Okay. So this is the business right there, okay, that I glossed over, which is in fact the hardest part of this problem. So if we do a calculation in which we just evolve this set of equations, the magnetic field doesn't grow at all, okay? And the problem is that because of magnetic moment conservation, if you grow the magnetic field a little bit, you generate a huge pressure anisotropy, and you can show analytically that that huge pressure anisotropy shuts off the MRI. However, that huge pressure anisotropy is unstable to kinetic instabilities, such as the fire hose, the mirror, cyclotron instability. So what we've done is we've said that the pressure anisotropy, P perp relative to P parallel, is always pinned at the threshold for kinetic micro instabilities, which basically means.
So this is not your equation state. There's another constraint.
That's correct.
Ah.
Yes, which is key and technical, so I didn't want to go into it. Basically, the pressure. Sorry, go ahead. Yes. Yes. Right, and the pressure anisotropy is basically that the difference in pressure from the perpendicular to the parallel temperature cannot be bigger in either sign with respect to B squared. That all of these instabilities have thresholds of delta P of order B squared with some number in front. Yes. Sure. That's correct. So we've included everything that we can calculate. Namely, we know when a plasma goes unstable and generates micro instabilities that isotropize the plasma. And those have been included essentially in this stuff that Omer correctly pointed out I glossed over in our equation of state. What we have not done, and which is always possible, is that I can say shocks and reconnection, other things like that, generate so much plasma noise at high frequencies that those pitch angles scatter and limit the mean free path of particles. Those are calculated, taking into account the pitch angle scattering by the anisotropies that we know how to calculate. Okay? But I do want to emphasize, it's actually an important point. It is in principle possible that there are all kinds of other there's all kinds of other high frequency power at the cyclotron frequency that's generated by shocks and reconnection and things we don't know how to calculate, that pitch angles scatter more effectively than what we've done here, that would limit the mean free path even more, and that would make things behave more like MHD. But I have no idea how to calculate that, so all we've done is calculate what we know how to calculate. Okay?
And
so I would hope that, you know, I think it's very plausible that with the assumptions I've laid out here, namely, you treat the collisionless plasma and you treat the effective mean free path by the micro instabilities that you know how to calculate, that we can describe the collisionless dynamics of the plasma in that limit. I think it will be very difficult to answer the question of, are there other things that limit the mean free path even more? But I should point out that if you look at the solar wind and you look at the Earth's magnetosphere, you know, the level of pressure anisotropy that you have in the solar wind and the Earth's magnetosphere is very consistent with the kinds of microinstabilities that we're talking about in these calculations. There are large pressure anisotropies in the solar wind. There is not some anomalous scattering which forces the solar wind to be a perfect scalar pressure. There's order unity pressure anisotropies at Earth. Okay, and that's consistent with the kinds of some calculations we're doing.
Okay, I'd like to cut off the questions there, except that Weymeyer, because he's sitting here and he's always behind me, and he's kind of waiting his time trying to get some attention. So one more question.
Can you check some of this with particle simulation?
So,
realize that's a lot of work, but,
right.
But at least some of your...
Yes, that's certainly a goal. So the downside of doing direct particle simulations is, of course, that your disk frequency at most will be 10 times lower than your cyclotron frequency, while in reality it's a billion times lower. And so your dynamic range from the outer scale of the disk to the cyclotron frequency will not be particularly good or particularly realistic. But you could imagine doing a global simulation of an accretion flow with particle and cell and hoping that you could compare the two methods and get similar answers.
That's
yes. Yeah. Using, I've talked to Anatoly about that. Sure.
Okay. You're doing it, Brian.
Okay. You have to solve the pulsar problem first. Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Elliot.